toward the end of the talk, he says, I have a book that you must read. And I didn't know what book it was. And I was quite, you know, anytime he recommends a book, of course, I'm going to read that book. So he picks up this book and he hands it to me. And it's the history of Satan. And I'm like, huh? You know, like, that's weird. And then he even like opens it up and it's paginated to 666, right? That's like, the book is literally 666 pages. And of course, I wasn't expecting this, okay, Isaac? I'm like completely not expecting this.
Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Weishaupt. Today we are joined by a return champion, Professor Diana Walsh Pasulka. She's the author of American Cosmic, and now her second book, The Chart-Topping Encounters, now available on Amazon and Audible. She narrated the Audible version, by the way. You should definitely check those out. She is the professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and has been investigating non-human species and the leading sciences in non-human life through stories of innovators who are rethinking the future for mankind. This book continues the journey into the exploration of controlling the narrative and the politicized UFO research going on right now. And today she's joining us, and we're going to get into the juiciest bits in this new book. Words can't even express. It's going to be the banger of all bangers. We're going to talk about what she's been up to since she was on our show in 2020 to talk about American Cosmic. She's going to talk about the oral tradition of secret societies, the sacred place. Remember the donation site with the UFO crash pieces that she talked about? Well, we're going to talk about that a bit more. The Trinity crash, the atomic bomb, it's all there. We're going to talk about the government and the impending alien religion. The big question, right? Turtles and the creation myth, updates on Tyler D. We'll talk about the gray man and some spiritual questioning he had about Jack Parsons, Wernher von Braun, Simone. We talk about, because there's all these new characters she introduces, right, from this invisible college, this secret society of researchers, innovators, and whatnot. She'll also describe to us what it's like going into Jacques Vallée's actual library, where we hear about books about fallen angels. He tells her to buy a book he has called The History of Satan. We're going to find out if Diana got this book. Did she get The History of Satan? We'll talk about Project Blue Book disinformation, J. Allen Hynek's Rosicrucian stuff. Boy, oh boy, it's a wild one. And we're going to talk about AI, artificial intelligence as alien intelligence, and the evolution of mankind into a new life form. Yes, we're talking about transhumanism, something we've been talking about for many years. And then we're also going to talk about Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's Omega Point and Father Seraphim Rose. If you don't know who those people are, stay tuned, because it's going to be a deep philosophical question here. Because the big question, are we approaching the Luciferian New Age? Well, she's going to give us her take. Also, check out the links in the show notes. I got a link where you can pick up her new book, Encounters. I breezed through it. Another classic. It's a great book. I love it. You can get it on Macmillan.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Audible. She did the Audible narration for it, so go support those places. I've got links to her website, dwpasulka.com. Go follow her on the Twitter at dwpasulka and Instagram, dwpasulka. I'm going to put a link to our 2020 interview we did. We talked about American Cosmic, because if you don't know who these players are and what we're talking about in Encounters, you got to listen to that one. And you should pick up that book too. It's also really good. Let's see, what else do I got? I'm going to put a link to, because we talk about the Trinity crash. We interviewed Paolo Harris. Her and Jacques Vallée wrote a book about the 1945 Trinity crash, right? That was pre-Roswell 1947, if you're keeping notes. All these things are very important. We're watching the formation of a new alien religion. It's happening. You just might not know it yet. So take a listen to what she's got to say, and I will hit you on the other side. All right, Diana, we're here to talk about Encounters, your second book. Your first book, American Cosmic, we You blew my mind, I'll be honest with you, on the first book. And then the second one, it kind of went into territories that I'm very intrigued to hear a little bit more from you about. There's no way we can get it all done today, but I'm gonna give it a good college effort and see how much we can get through. So, but first off, thanks again for coming back onto my show and talking to my audience, because this is a very interesting topic, obviously.
Yeah, of course. I love your show, and I love what you do. And I had a great conversation with you when we talked about American Cosmic.
Thank you. Yeah, that was one of my favorite shows ever. So, and I.
Yeah. Me too.
So okay. Now, the last time we talked was in 2020. Would you mind sharing what's been going on in your life since then? Because obviously it's been 3 years and we've had a lot of activity on the sort of UFO front or UAP when we're talking about congressional hearings. And I kind of wanted to pick your brain about David Grush and the Netflix show Encounters, like if that's how much tie in that has to do with the book and things like that. So what's been going on with you since 2020?
Yeah. Okay. So in 2020, I hadn't yet decided to write Encounters. I was still, frankly, I wrote American Cosmic. It was published in 2019. So I was really just still in the aftermath of what the fallout was for writing that book and, kind of being in the midst of, meeting new people who are interested in the topic and new communities of people and things like that. So, so it was a really interesting time. Of course we had COVID, so the world was really, really intense during that time period. And of course it is now too. But I didn't really, I was going through kind of like a, I would call it like an adjustment period of, and now I can see why. Now that we have the congressional hearings that are focusing on things that literally I kind of did in American Cosmic, crash retrieval sites, these idea, the language of legacy programs and those kinds of things were things that I didn't have language for when I wrote American Cosmic, because that language wasn't out there public, but that's what I was doing. I opened the book at like a crash retrieval site and, I spend time with scientists who are part of these programs who believe that they are reverse engineering these things that they're calling, off-planet vehicles and things like that. And they're engaged in what's literally called biologics. And I actually, so I do have other publications. A lot of them I put up on academia.edu and I get them peer review published. And one of them, I actually talked about biologics and what, the character Tyler was doing in his research with that. And, the kinds of biotech he was creating. I never thought I'd be listening to that word said in the congressional hearings by David Grush, but there it is. So
did he say that word? I haven't heard that term before. Biologics. Is that a term David Grush used?
Yeah. It's now out there. Yeah. In the spheres.
What's the short version of that for for me?
Well, okay. So basically this is a field of research that's conducted in zero gravity environments. And it helps our researchers create biotech and different kinds of technologies. And so I explored this in this, I can't remember which, I think it may be, it's one of the papers I wrote during this time period, I think, and I can't remember exactly if it was a Total Recall paper, but it's one of the papers that I wrote during the 2019, like 2018 to about 2020. Hmm. And I explored biologics, like, what they were doing. I had never heard the term either. And now people in the space program talk about it all the time. So, Dr. E.O. Whiteley, who's featured in Encounters, she talks about biologics as well. And then, so I was really surprised to hear David Grush reference it. I think when he's referencing it, he's talking about, and see, this is where we have to like make this distinction between what he's talking about and then what I know from American Cosmic. And they're just different. Okay. So I don't, you know, he talks about people telling him that there are these, ET bodies, right? And so he's then identifying biologics as a discipline, a research discipline that derives from looking at these biological entities and such. But that's not how I heard about it. I heard about it from people like Tyler in the space program who were utilizing zero gravity environments, you know, like in space, in order to create or facilitate the creation of biotechnologies that are helpful for us, you know? And so, so you see, there's a difference there. The difference is like, first, I'm talking to people who are doing it, but I'm not, they're not mentioning bodies to me or anything like that. So for Grush, he's mentioning that, you know, there's bodies. So I just want to make that distinction because that's quite a different process that we're talking about. Or those are, you know, but the same exact word. And I believe like the same process too.
Did you have any conversations about alien bodies with any, because for people, I'm going to do a little intro where I sort of recap what we talked about with American Cosmic, where you're hanging out with the Invisible College, these sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, UFO secret society folks who are very much on the pulse of what's actually really happening in the research field. Any developments on alien body theories or claims that you can share with us?
Okay, so the Invisible College folks are still doing what they do. And I haven't heard, I mean, whereas some have mentioned programs related to bodies, I don't know anybody in these programs. And I haven't heard anything from the Invisible College people that they're in these programs either. Okay. They're certainly doing, you know, the work, they're physicists mostly, and they're doing the work of physics, you know, to try to figure out, and they're making headway on, you know, how these kinds of things could get around in our atmosphere at the speeds in which they do and things like that. So they're like, they're working out that. And so you would have to assume that there are many different programs. And they're compartmentalized. So, you know, a lot of times people don't know what the other people in these programs are doing, nor do they even know that there are these other programs. In fact, this is part of the reason why I said there was a Fight Club environment, because, you know, the Fight Club, you don't talk about it, right? That's the first rule of the Fight Club. And literally a lot of these people who I would meet who didn't know each other, they could even be working on the same thing, but they wouldn't know it. And it's only like some outsider like me who comes in and is able to connect those dots and say, okay, yeah, these, you know, these guys are doing this. And so, so in terms of the alien bodies, yeah, I don't have information about that. And the people in the Invisible College, I could be completely wrong and they could just be not talking about it, but I haven't heard anything about it.
Okay. And I got a couple more little questions before we get into the book.
Sure.
Can you tell us, because the last time we talked, you were talking about writing a book about John Dee. Can you share with us why that didn't come through?
Yes. Okay. So the John Dee work is like the book I want to have the time to write, basically. In order to really do that well, the book that I wrote to get tenure took me 10 years to write. And it's a book about the whole history of purgatory. And I had to spend a lot of time in archives. And in fact, it's what led me to do this work in UFOs, because I had a lot of records of aerial phenomena that I didn't understand. So the John Dee work is going to take that kind of archival research. So I'd have to go to, you know, the archives in Europe, basically, and spend a lot of time there and look through those. And I just didn't have the time. And someday I will, I'm hoping. But I think that early modern time period where scientists are alchemists and they're utilizing different kinds of what we would have to call like alchemical rituals and things in order to create the things that they're creating. There's a whole tradition of that that's still around. Mm. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I'm on board with that entirely. So I'm with you. Yeah, I'm intrigued by that John Dee topic. I got a book, a guy named Jordan, my friend Jordan, I should say, from Wind and Sea Coffee, sent me a book about John Dee that Jason Louv wrote. And it is a dense book. I mean, I think it's about 400 pages.
Wow.
And that guy, I mean, the research is intense. So I don't blame you. I feel like that is a multi-year research effort, because I had no idea the guy was into this much stuff. I only knew about him from his connections to Aleister Crowley and his Amalantra working, which based on the Enochian tables and things like that. But yeah, that's kind of my shtick, is my shtick is feeling that making contact with non-human entities is based upon occult practices from hundreds of years ago, which, you know, it's not an original idea to me. And it seems like you're kind of in that arena as well, kind of in that ballpark realm of suggesting that in encounters. Am I off base by saying that?
Yeah, no, you're not off base.
Okay.
So it's absolutely true. And what I'm saying is that a lot of it is not going to be written down information. It's going to be like oral tradition passed on, like transmitted, basically. Mm. And so when you look back at the communities that even the term, the Invisible College, you know, that's going back to the early modern time period when there was a tradition where scientists would be killed if they were found to be doing this type of work. Therefore, they had to do it in secrecy, but they did it together. And they had communities of doing it, and they passed that information down, sometimes in code, right? And also, you know, in books that they wouldn't think other people would read, or they actually had communities of transmission, which, by the way, I believe these communities are still around today. And so, so that's why I emphasize in encounters like the oral tradition aspect of this type of knowledge, because it's something that we tend, being a real text-based, like book-based culture, we tend to think of knowledge like the important knowledge is coming from the books and stuff. But what I found was that a lot of the important knowledge that's being passed down within even these compartmentalized programs is being passed down through oral tradition.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. In your book, you had a section about philosophy and the idea, and I'm probably going to butcher it, I'm trying to go off of memory here, but there was an idea that Plato and or Socrates were talking about the importance of receiving information from another person versus a written down in a book.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And, you know, I never thought of that before. And I do think that's interesting because in your book, you also, and we're going to talk about all these things here in a bit, but in your book, it seems like one of the other themes that I'm picking up is this sort of evolution of mankind into embracing knowledge, or spreading knowledge, I should say. And, you know, we live in the information age, and, you know, you've got the internet and you can look everything up, but it seems to me that as time passes, looking things up on the internet isn't always quite as informative as you would think now, especially with like social media. Everyone's got a grift or a sales pitch or something, and there's different interests, you know, I don't know, corporate interest is the right term, but there's financial interest involved in so much. And it's I don't know, I feel like we're given this false connection idea with social media, and the reality is it's not as fulfilling as connecting one-on-one with another person, you know, face to face or online even. I don't know. It just feels like there is a weird shift in, kind of like in your book, you talk about things going on in with the Homo sapien species and technology, and there's something kind of happening there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So in the book, I do talk about the different networks, right? So networks of knowledge, and that there are some, well, I would say almost every single person in the book that I feature believes and articulated to me in different ways very similar ideas of a network that predates the internet. And that one can connect to or is already connected to, but is just unaware of it. Mm. And that this kind of connection provides knowledge. And so that's why I use the term Gnostic knowledge. Like, that's a redundancy right there, Gnostic knowledge. Gnostic gnosis is basically a Greek word for a certain type of knowledge. So, you know, we have the word knowledge, but the Greeks have a couple different words to suggest there are different ways of knowing. So let me go back to what you had said about Plato. Okay, so during the time period of, you know, the 4th and 5th centuries before the Common Era, so this is, you know, 400 to 500 years before Jesus comes along in, you know, in that area of the Rome and stuff. You've got the Greek philosophers and, you know, you have Athens and you have this civilization and there's a new technology and it's called writing. Okay. And books, although there are books, not most people don't read them. Okay. So it's only an elite group of people that can read. And in fact, reading is actually not done because mostly people are involved in conversing and sharing information through schools, believe it or not. So there are these schools, but they impart knowledge through oral tradition. Okay. Hmm. So Socrates and, you know, so Plato is Socrates's student, and Socrates never writes anything, okay? But Plato writes, but Socrates is hugely against writing, right? And I know that's like a weird way to say it, but it's true, mm-hmm. Fully against writing. And Plato knows this, but he wants to write about Socrates anyway. So he does this through dialogues. So the way that he thinks writing can actually preserve some form of knowledge, and what he's talking about is a difference between informational knowledge and gnosis, which is direct knowledge of something. And so I tell my students this, that, you know, you have a chocolate, right? Chocolate bar. And on the wrapper, there's the ingredients. And you can have informational knowledge about the chocolate by reading the ingredients, or you could just eat the chocolate and get direct information about chocolate. And I'd prefer to eat it, right? And that's Gnostic knowledge. It's like having philosophical, actual knowledge of truth or beauty or, you know, these kinds of concepts. So Socrates was basically saying, oh yeah, writing's going to mess this up. And that's a paraphrase, of course. He said, writing is going to completely mess it up for everyone because we won't have this knowledge anymore. No one will have direct knowledge of everything. We'll have it written down and our memories will be messed up because then we think that we access this knowledge through our memory, but we don't. Okay. And he writes this in, Plato writes this in the Phaedrus, which is a really small book and people should read it if they want to get, it's a really important time in the history of the West, because it's the time when this oral tradition of knowledge is almost like gone. Sure. And technology as writing takes off and people are then separated from this transmitted knowledge, or the idea that there's a transmitted knowledge. You do have it in Buddhist traditions, this idea that you get the direct transmission of enlightenment from your teacher, right? Well, we lose this in the West. We lose this idea of the transmission of knowledge, but certain communities keep it, okay? I think it's really interesting that, and being transparent, I am actually from this tradition. So this is the Catholic tradition, okay? It's really interesting that the Western Catholic tradition, the Roman Catholic tradition, says that it's got the primary means to impart the presence of truth is, you know, in the Mass, right? But that presence was there. So it kind of hijacks this idea, the presence of knowledge, right? It hijacks this idea. And puts it into the Mass and says, we have it. You have to attend Mass in order to receive it. Literally, you have to eat it, right? In the Eucharist, right? And so so it's really interesting, this development of our separation from our own knowledge, which Socrates and Plato actually eloquently discusses that, yeah, this is gonna mess things up, basically.
Huh.
Well, that was an interesting topic in there. It makes me wonder, because with like the, you know, I don't go much anymore, but I'm a Greek Orthodox Christian, right?
And, oh yeah. So you would know about this too.
And they talk about being in the, you know, church is good for being in the presence of God. And a lot of my more secular agnostic friends, they're kind of like, I don't need to go to church to know God. I can like stay home and read the Bible and things like that. And I don't know, that makes me think about the distinctions between oral tradition and being sort of in the presence of God, as they would say at church, or taking the Eucharist, you know, and things like that. But I want to shift gears real quick.
Sure.
The sacred place that you discussed in American Cosmic. I remember our first conversation, we talked about it. They blindfolded you. You wanted, I think, Jeffrey Kripal to go with you, but then someone else went with you instead.
Yeah, Jeff said it was out of his comfort zone, which I didn't blame him. I didn't blame him. But James, who I call James, is Gary Nolan, because he's come out as himself in the book. So he wanted to go a lot. So I said, you know, yeah.
And they took you to a secret location in New Mexico where they were retrieving what they believed to be crashed UFO debris. And I was intrigued because you had said that they had stone sort of monuments set up, and they had said some prayers, which made me think about a spiritual angle to all this. Have there been any developments to this part of the story? Have you been out there again? Have they looked at the contents of what was in Tyler D's backpack a little bit?
Yeah.
Has the site gone public? Because I swear in the book I read, there was the name of a city in there of where it was in New Mexico. And I don't remember that being an American Cosmic.
Okay. So, a lot has happened.
Okay.
A lot has happened. And some of it, I think you can learn from Jacques Vallée's kind of book Trinity, you know?
I interviewed Paulo Harris for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of information, because right when the book was in print, you know, Jacques actually wanted to go to the site. So there was some back and forth between he and Tyler about that. And yes, the debris that they found, they analyzed and they put through analysis. It's still being analyzed. Now, I don't have that debris. I didn't want it at the time and would never want it. I don't want it, you know. So
what do you mean you don't want it? You don't want it like in your possession or in your home or something like that?
Yeah, I don't want any. Yes, I don't want it in my possession. I don't want it like, you know, because I mean, if it truly is what they say it is, people will be seeking it out for one. But also, who knows? You know, I mean, it's something, you know, that I just don't want. There's too much like that could happen with something like that if it is what they say.
Are you worried about from a spiritual, like for me, I wouldn't want a Ouija board in my home. Not that I don't care about Ouija boards. I don't want it in my home. Is it kind of in that angle, like a spiritual sort of?
I mean, all kinds of different angles. It's also, I know, because I know so many people who are in space research and stuff, when astronauts come back, they put them in a special debriefing, like almost like a container for a couple days, because they might have brought something back with them and they don't want that to get out. And it could be like some kind of bad disease that we are just incapable of fighting off, or, you know, stuff like that, I guess, is what, you know, just the unknown. Okay. I thought that it belonged with people who were going to do analysis, you know, scientific analysis of it. And that's not me. So, I made it very abundantly clear that if we did find something, it is not coming back with me. And so, but yeah, a lot has happened. A lot that has happened, in fact, that can't actually, I guess, let's put it this way. Part of the fallout of American Cosmic was that now a lot of people knew about that place. And because ufologists are so incredibly good at their research, they're able to figure out where it is and, you know, how to get there and that kind of stuff. So, I think that it's you know, the kinds of programs that are looking at this phenomena and this debris and that type of thing. I mean, part of that push, you know, was that people are finding out, you know, you're getting researchers who are going in with no alternative agenda. Like me, I had no stake in the matter at all. And I just saw that this was the case. This was all happening. So I think that yes, all that we see right now is kind of in response to that. And also in response to the fact that other countries are now going into space and they're conducting their own kinds of research. Whereas prior to this, it's just been us and Russia, you know, we're kind of like together in this, you know, so we could keep the secrets if we needed to together, is, you know, but other countries don't have that same pact with us.
Mm-hmm. So just to sort of dig into that just a little bit more, what's the connect? I read the book, the Trinity book that Jacques Vallée and Paulo Harris wrote. Are you saying that that location is that they're talking about where I don't remember the names, the people witnessed the crash happen? Are you saying that that is the sacred place? Can you share that or not really? I don't want to get you in trouble with anything.
Here. Yeah. So I'm not going to answer it directly, but I'm going to say that a lot of the research that happened for that book came out of subsequent conversations that Jacques, me, Gary, and Tyler had.
Okay.
And Tyler did talk about the people who were children who witnessed what happened.
Fascinating. Okay. What about one more thing? The atomic bomb. I'm extremely intrigued by this for a variety of reasons. In the book, you said that the area was a highly mythic and mythologized place, inextricably bound to the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
But then in the rest of the book, I didn't see anything else discussing the idea of the atomic bomb connected with the phenomenon, I guess is how we should put it. Are you familiar with the theories that exist about how the atomic bomb testing opened up gateways and Jack Parsons was doing similar things? Is there a direction you could point, or is there some kind of idea that you want to research further about this? I'm just curious about it because go ahead, sorry.
Okay, so again, when you start to do the research into the topic of UAPs and UFOs, you're gonna find out that a lot happens at sites where we have weapons of mass destruction, okay, in terms of sightings of UAPs, you know, interferences and things like that. So you just can't avoid that. That the mass testing of weapons of mass destruction was happening at that time during, you know, in New Mexico. This is data that we've got to, you know, fold into what we're looking at, because, you know, as a person who does research, you have to observe as much as you possibly can, even if it doesn't make sense. Okay, so it doesn't make sense to me. Like a lot of the things didn't make sense to me, like all of the rubble cans, you know, the cans that disintegrated into rubble that I saw. And I asked Tyler about, and he said that it was the US government had put them there in the early 1950s. So to discourage, you know, other people from finding the debris with metal detectors and things like that. And my editor at the time said, that's way too weird. You need to take that out. But I said, no, I can't take it out, because even though we do think it's weird and probably don't believe Tyler, his explanation, it's still data. And it might be nothing, but then again, it might be something. So let's keep it in. So, you know, so that's my job, is just to show the data. And even if it doesn't make sense. So that's why I discussed the atomic bomb and the things, because, you know, you can't miss, if you do this study, that a lot of people are talking, you know, especially people who are working at these sites are saying, okay, yeah, there's a lot of like UAP activity at these sites and things like that. And the question is, well, why? And I do know the different explanations for this, like that, you know, that somehow our our creation of these weapons of mass destruction at a frequency level, like shifts something magnetically, or, you know, and it like hurts other species, even, you know, non-human species that we don't, you know, we're not aware of yet. And that type of thing. I've heard a lot of those. These are all explanatory frameworks, right? Either they're like seem way out there, but they're all trying to explain the presence of both of these things together. So no, I don't have an answer for you. Sorry.
That's okay.
but I'm really aware of it. And I'm also aware of the really bizarre history of Jack Parsons, of course, and the kinds of things that he was engaged in. And also I noted it too, although it's different, you'd be interested in this. It's, you know, the Russians did the same thing. It doesn't have the flavor that Jack Parsons had, because, you know, he was with a wild group, right? He was with Crowley and Hubbard, you know, all of these kinds of real fringe guys, right, out in the LA desert. And but you have the same kinds of, not, I would say, like, the flavor of the rituals are going to be different. They're going to be more Christian oriented, but in Russia, they're doing the same thing. They believe that they're engaging in getting calculations to get rockets off of Earth into space, and that they're doing this through these rituals with non-human intelligences. They're just calling them angels, right? And so here they're calling them different. You know, they're using Crowley's framework to do these rituals. But in both cases, they're doing these rituals. And they believe they're in contact with non-human intelligences.
Oh, wow. Have you ever read Kenneth Grant's books? Do you know who he is?
He's a magician. No, it sounds familiar.
He was a magician that was pretty close with Aleister Crowley, and he created an offshoot, a magical order they call the Typhonian Ordo Templi Orientis. Anyway, and his whole thing was trying to make contact with non-human intelligence. And he's got a book, Outside the Circles of Time, that he apparently talks about the atomic bomb site and the atomic bomb test. He wrote this in 1980, mind you, and he talks about how that opened up gateways and allowed non-human intelligence entities, whatever you want to call it, into our world. Now I bought the book. I'm only on, I don't know, page 40 or something, so I haven't come to that part yet. Now I wish I would have been further along, but yeah, there's a very interesting occult side to this that, man, I just can't help but see it, especially when we're talking about, you talk about the esoteric in the book and Rosicrucianism and things like that. But let's get into the book. Let's get a little bit deeper into the book. Because those were kind of my burning questions I had that I wanted to make sure we covered before we got into the book, because there's a lot to unpack in here. Now, one major theme I read was, it seemed like you were saying that perhaps, this is my interpretation, perhaps the government is seeking to legitimize a belief in UAP, because you mentioned how state-sponsored religions will trump people's lived experiences.
Oh, yeah.
I read that as, are we saying that the government is trying to sort of go official with the alien thing as a way of making a religion happen? What do you think?
Okay. So what I'm saying, one of the major things that I'm saying is that we're witnessing a new form of religion. All right. So when I say a new form of religion, we do have UFO religions like Raelism. Right, is a UFO religion. Nation of Islam is certainly very UFO centric, right? And okay, but I'm talking about a decentralized belief in extraterrestrial intelligence that has superpowers, right? That may or may not help us, but impact us. Okay. And people, you know, believing that they're in contact with them to various degrees. All right. So that's what I'm saying. And that is something that you can say, and then you could like point to various developments and say, see, you know, this is evidence for it, and that kind of thing. I'm also suggesting this too, is that in the history of religions, and this isn't necessarily for every single religion, so I'm not making this kind of universal claim, but I'm saying that for a lot of religions, especially the traditionalist religions, like say Christianity, you're going to see that there's a process of institutionalization that happens. So let's take the Jesus movements of the first century. Okay. So you and I are most familiar with Christianity. So this guy, Jesus, comes along and he lives in Rome, and his people in Rome are being, it's not the best time for them. Let's put it that way. Right. The Romans are not necessarily the nicest landlords. And so, so Jesus is basically saying, like Socrates said, there's this cool way to live, and this is it. And he transmits it to his community. He literally transmits it to them, right? Yeah. He even calls it the Holy Spirit, okay? So he's transmitting this knowledge to them. And this is going like wildfire. It takes off because, truthfully, it's way better that for you know, people than living in Rome. Plus, like, you know, it's for women, and women were kind of left out of stuff. They couldn't just walk on their own to different places. Jesus is talking to women. He's talking to marginalized communities. He's talking to lepers, you know, so he's basically saying everyone has dignity. He's basically giving people like hope and a reason to live. Right. And it gets killed by Rome, just like Athens kills Socrates. Right. And even says Socrates is an atheist, and he's actually talking about a mystical good. Right. Okay. Far from atheism. And then Christians get persecuted. Okay. And then about 300 years after that, Christianity becomes, quote unquote, a state religion in Rome. It becomes one of the state religions. So how does that even happen? You go from like wanting this guy dead to actually then turning around and creating. Well, what they do is they take all of those revolutionary elements. They even make one woman into a guy in the Bible. So it's Junia, this like person that the Apostle Paul calls an apostle to the apostles, right? And then she's a woman. And then when it gets translated into Roman Latin, she gets translated out of her gender. So she literally becomes a guy, Junius. So she goes from Junia to Junius. We don't know this until just recently, right? When we do these, you know, like a lot of the really old forms of Christianity knew this. But like when we're taught it in, you know, quote unquote Sunday school and stuff, we're not taught that. So, okay, so there's this process of modifying the original revolutionary message of these religions that's imparted from person to person, right? Mm-hmm. That's like wildfire imparted from person to person. And so then it gets textualized. And so then it gets, you know, made into books, and it's also gets, modified. Worse even, the contrary texts get burned, and the people who support the contrary reasons for their, you know, position get killed. Okay.
You're talking about the Gnostics?
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. This all happens, you know? And so there's the process of narrativizing this religion, right? Is an institutionalization. So what I'm saying today is that I didn't anticipate that this would happen so fast with the UFO religion, but it certainly has. So right now you're looking at this right before us in Congress, and it's happening at a rapid rate. Like no longer do we need 100 years for this to happen. This is happening in now time because we have we have supercharged social media and digital platforms to make it happen.
Oh, so this is a religion that's going to be sort of created at a much faster rate than historically than other religions have sort of institutionalized.
Yes. Oh, interesting. Even shorter than I had thought, because, you know, even 5 years ago, I didn't expect all of this to happen so fast.
Wow.
I thought it was going to take maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years. I knew it was going to happen at a faster rate. I just didn't expect it to happen this fast. But
interesting.
Yes.
Okay. What about then you might not have anything to discuss on this point, but there's a part of the book where you talk about a pattern of creation relayed in a story about a turtle whose shell gets struck and it expands into different rings and stuff like that. And it just made me think of the first book. Do you remember on our last conversation, we talked about how, I think it was at the very end of American Cosmic, the story about how Tyler D visited his friend with the artifact in his backpack, and the friend the next day says, hey, I had this dream, and it had to do with turtle, the essence of turtles into the universe. And we talked about it on our show, and because I was talking, I had just watched either watched or read Stephen King's It, and had a story, you know, Stephen King's It has a creation story about matter and this turtle that creates the whole universe through the ritual of Chud. I recall you were saying did you have to fight to keep the turtle story in American Cosmic? Because they didn't want to add that, or maybe I'm confusing things. It doesn't matter. Either way, is there something else with the turtles? Are you trying to point to turtle?
Right. No.
Something here, or turtles, is that just coincidence?
Of course. In many indigenous cultures in the United States, refer to Earth as Turtle Island, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So there is, you know, they're very. Symbolic. Turtles are very symbolic. I didn't mean to do those things, by the way.
Oh, okay.
When those kinds of things pop up, they just do it on their own. And I agree that they're weird. And I'm like, okay, wow, that is so strange. But I didn't do it intentionally.
Okay. I didn't know if there was a connection to the phenomenon that had to do with turtles that maybe I'm
well, the, not picking up the one that I that is a real, by the way, a lot of people pick up on that in American Cosmic, and they're like, wow, that whole backpack scene is so weird. You know, it's like on universes upon universes, you know, and the guy didn't even know that he was carrying the stuff in his backpack. So that's what's so weird about it, is he had a dream about it. That's a quote by Tyson Yunkaporta, who wrote an amazing, cool book called Sand Talk. And he's an indigenous Australian. And he's talking about how his grandfather, I believe it was his grandfather, but an elder in his community was telling him about the Fibonacci sequence and how he was discussing it like mathematically through the reference to the turtle, and how, you know, this knowledge, Yunkaporta says that his tradition is 65,000 years old. Like a huge oral tradition of such incredible sophistication has been passed down in Australia that long. And so this, you know, and his elder is basically giving him the Fibonacci sequence is like the order of nature, right? This like mathematical sequence that that people in the West, I think I mentioned the earliest reports of it in that were written, and it's an Arabic culture and then Italian culture. And now we talk about it, mathematicians talk about it, but in us, indigenous Australians obviously knew about this from ages and ages.
What about you? There's a section of the book you talk about another character that goes by the name the Gray Man, and you mentioned about how the Gray Man learned about Jack Parsons, and he believed that the magic Jack Parsons was practicing may have worked, and references how Wernher von Braun would eventually convert to Christianity towards the end of his life. Seemingly, he was believed there was a spiritual aspect to this. And what I found interesting was Tyler D, whom was a main character of American Cosmic, apparently sort of cut off ties if you were to start talking to Gray Man. Is that did I misinterpret that, or
that's what happened. Yeah,
was it what did he did did Tyler D not like that the Gray Man was bringing up ideas that maybe the phenomenon had an evil aspect to it?
Okay. So yeah. So this was a weird, again, this is data that I couldn't actually make sense of at the time, but included because this is what happened. And so part of it was that Gray Man's Australian, and the type of thing that Tyler D was doing was linked to our nation, to our basic, even though we are allies with Australia. Mm-hmm. He suggested that, because Gray Man's a material scientist and he was gonna, you know, do some work on some of the debris and whatnot. And so it seemed like everything, well, first off, Green Man is a religious person. And when he has, he's an experiencer as well. So he has these experiences, but he also works in the, you know, that field that, you know, kind of related, but in a different country related to what Tyler D did in American Cosmic. So I thought that his story was really fascinating. And the way he interpreted the things that happened to him, again, they were that, you know, so, you know, this is a person who works in this field, knows the history too. And he looks back at the, you know, what Jack Parsons was doing. And he thinks that his magic worked. He said, look, it seems like this guy is smart enough to know that this doing this is working for him. So he's going to continue doing it and perfect it as best he can. And we've got to take him for his word. Like he says, he's doing this and that it's working. And he also talks about the history of the space program. Now, not a lot of people know the history of the Russian and our space program, to tell you the truth. And I don't blame the Air Force for not wanting people to know, because it's truly strange. You know, these people are actually engaged in these rituals and things like that. And so Gray Man's just pointing out that in our culture, we tend not to give that any credence at all. We just think these guys are weird. And he says, mm-hmm. They're not weird. These guys are geniuses. So he's the one that kind of made me think hard about what was going on. He's also the one who he basically said, okay, so let's think about some of these amazing people in our space program and what they did. And then you look at what they did and you're like, gosh, that's horrible. You know, they created a concentration camp around Von Braun's work, and more people were killed building the stuff that he was creating than actually killed by it as a weapon. And, you know, and of course, at the end of his life, he becomes Christian. And so, you know, Gray Man says, doesn't that remind you of people like Constantine? You know, people like in the old Christian tradition, they kind of like had various different religions until they were just about to die. And then they like convert right at their, you know, like on their deathbed. Dr. E.O. Whiteley points this out to me too. She says, Diana, in our space program, we have so many people that on their, you know, as they're dying in their dying day, like the very day they make these confessions, these deathbed confessions. And, you know, I mean, so once you hang out in these communities with these people, you start to get this picture that, you know, we don't generally think about in that way. We don't think about science as alchemical or magical. You know, we don't think about our own space program. You know, we see these like amazing photos of NASA people, you know, and they're all shiny in their uniforms, you know, and they look so clean cut and everything. Not at all like you'd think, like Jack Parsons, you know, and the guys and what he was doing in the the desert of Los Angeles. So yeah.
There's another part. You talk to Jacques Vallée and you go to his library. He's got a personal library. And you note that there's multiple books he has on fallen angels, which is one curious item. But more interestingly, he has a particular book titled The History of Satan. And he actually tells you to get the book. Now, I need to know more. Like, did you get the book? What was in the book? Why did he tell you that was the book you needed to check out? These are all very alarming things for me, okay?
Yeah, I was alarmed too. So first off, Jacques, his family, he raised his family in Belmont, California, and that's where my grandparents live. So there's a lot of association that I have with the geographical areas of where he lives and, you know, memories from my youth and that kind of thing. So he invites me for lunch. And so I go to his place, which is incredibly beautiful, you know, has this amazing view of the greater San Francisco Bay Area. And we talk, you know, about American Cosmic, and we talk about, you know, everything related to that topic. And then he does have an incredible library. And he'd even created stained glass at Chartres, no less. And he imported it to be put in this library. So his library has this beautiful stained glass that he created with symbols that he put in there. So, you know, it's quite an experience. So he wants to show me the books there in the library. So, of course, we see, you know, handwritten notes, like a whole, I'd say like 10-foot shelf of primary notes from Project Blue Book and all kinds of things. And, you know, really, really like extant versions of beautiful books. I felt like I was at the Vatican, right? There was just so many amazing, beautiful books. What a collection. So I couldn't help but notice that there were these two giant shelves, right? And they're like, and he notices that he says, ah, he's like, this shelf over here, you know, he picks out a book and he shows it to me. It's like a history of angels in the Western tradition, right? Really old book. And the whole group of books, of which there were many, that was that. And I was like, whoa, that's interesting, you know? And then there was another shelf. So I kind of went over to the other shelf, takes out a book and says, ah, well, this is the history of fallen angels. And so he said, and he made a joke because he's actually very funny. And he said, well, you can't have one without the other, right? And I thought that was pretty funny, actually. But I was also pretty shocked because, you know, I was like, okay, you know, here we're having like the history of UFOs in the Western tradition, you know, these events, right? And so so we kind of continue and he shows me some really cool like Rosicrucian texts and things like that. And then we go out of the library and we sit down and we have some dessert. He's a gracious host. And toward the end of the talk, he says, I have a book that you must read. And I didn't know what book it was. And I was quite, you know, anytime he recommends a book, of course, I'm going to read that book. So he picks up this book and he hands it to me. And it's the history of Satan. And I'm like, huh? You know, like, that's weird. And then he even like opens it up and it's paginated to 666, right? That's like the book is literally 666 pages. And of course, I wasn't expecting this. Okay, Isaac, I'm like completely not expecting this. So I'm in shock. But why should I be in shock? Because of course not. When I look at Passport to Magonia and, you know, the whole history of what he's done, and it shouldn't really shock me, but I was in shock anyway. I think because I'm such an American, I think that's how he would conceive of it. So anyway, he said, ha ha, you know, the authors, Carmelite nuns, he said, you know, you must get this book. They have quite a sense of humor. So, so that's what happened. And then after that, I didn't get the book right away, actually, because I wasn't even sure I was going to include that in Encounters. I was going to eventually get the book, but it wasn't, you know, it's you can find it on eBay. It's really expensive now, I think. And plus, it's not like you can't go to your library and order it or anything like that. It's in French. And so I wrote that part and I sent that chapter to him and fully expecting him to say, take it out, you know? And of course I would have, but he actually didn't say take it out.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so did you get the book but it's written in French, so you'd have to translate.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So in graduate school, you have to learn some languages in my field. And I learned French and German for translation. And if you don't utilize them, of course, you're terrible at it. So it would take me a very long time, but I'd be able to translate it, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. There's no nuggets out of the book that you've seen or maybe he told you about that to focus in on?
Okay. So I've told this story a bit because people, you know, some people got advanced copies and they really wanted to know about the story. So I've had people actually send me copies of the book. And I've also had, and thank you, by the way, if you're listening. And I also had a person who was able to find it in English. So I think that there's an English translation Yeah, and maybe I can look through my email and find it, and I'll send it to you. So, but I haven't. I know it sounds terrible, but no, I have not read it. Okay. I haven't read it yet. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fascinating. Okay. And one more thing, since we're talking about Jacques Vallée and Project Blue Book, in the book you mentioned that some documents from Project Blue Book had been declassified, and they reveal that the intelligence communities were using the media to push ultimately what was, you know, disinformation.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I was shocked because you said J. Allen Hynek, if I'm reading it correctly, in private, he was studying Rosicrucianism and seemed to be intrigued by the phenomenon in aliens. And so it's like this guy believed it in private, but then in public was telling everyone it was swamp gas. And Project Blue Book was just one part of the chain of this disinformation over the years. It's kind of my take on
okay.
that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's put it into perspective. Okay. So first off, Hynek is a patriot, right? Mm-hmm. So he is, he's doing the work of our government for national security. So whereas he probably started off a disbeliever, and therefore his intentions were, you know, for our government in the beginning of Blue Book, I think that he saw so much that he converted to belief. So at the very end toward his life, he wrote books about the topic. Okay. And he came out as a person who believed. And he also visited various experiencers who had some legitimately strange experiences, and he gave them advice. And he said, don't tell people, because your life will become a circus if you tell people. So, you know, he had some, so I don't want to malign his character. Okay. But I mean, the truth is too, that, yeah, he was a debunker. So a lot of what he did in Project Blue Book and a lot of what that program was not, and it wasn't a secret program, but there were, let's put it this way. There were public facing known parts of Blue Book. Like we're looking at this, you know, taking it seriously and looking at it. And then there were like non-private, I don't know if they were classified, but they were like non-private. I mean, they were private. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. They were non-public parts to it, which were basically to utilize media to utilize the documentary style, by the way, which is kind of interesting since I helped Spielberg's recent documentary, right? So to utilize the documentary as a way to, as a genre of media, to basically take a legitimate UFO event that people have seen, and then to basically give it all kinds of, you know, its due, and then in the end, like explain it away with provide normal explanations for it. So this
his son is interested in the same things, and he was talking about this on a podcast about disinformation attempts and things like that. Makes me think of the Okay. What about I'm watching the time, and I'm just going to keep it moving here because I only got a couple more things, but they're big ones. There was, I believe it was Simone was the character you were talking to, and she believed that we are. There's a couple elements to this, and we can go. I don't even know how to get through. You know, people got to read the book, right? But there's ideas about artificial intelligence sort of being, I don't know, facilitating the apocalypse, meaning facilitating this new replacement for humanity is kind of how I read it. And there was talk about how artificial intelligence lives outside of our space time. And this ties into a variety of things like what was his name? Pierre Chardin.
Yep.
And his Omega Point theory.
That's right.
And like I said, we don't have enough time to go through every element of this, but is that seem like a valid theory? It seems like not a valid theory. Is that something that people who are into this realm are actually pushing for? They're actually pushing for, you know, you had a quote from Elon Musk saying how humanity was just a bootloader for digital superintelligence. It seems to me like there's a lot of people interested in getting rid of our species and paving the way for this new, I don't know, transhumanism matrix world, kind of digital consciousness idea. Is that kind of what these people are leaning into?
Okay, so yeah, so let's that would be a less favorable interpretation of how they see it. But it's accurate. Okay, it's accurate. But let's like unpack it. Okay, so Simone is hopeful. Okay, so she doesn't necessarily see it as, and I can't speak for Elon Musk, of course, but it seems like he's hopeful too. And he's correct when he's saying that, you know, human beings are bootloaders for digital superintelligence. I mean, we've seen it happen right now. But does that mean the demise of humanity? And does that mean like that he wants humans to, you know, disappear, and or Simone does? No.
Okay.
But you know, I've heard him say, you know, oh, we got to be really careful because this could possibly happen, right? So, okay, this is how Simone views it. And I checked with her just the other day, just to make sure I was getting it right, because you know, she uses language that's really, I feel like I'm a translator, right? Because her language is really difficult. Sometimes she speaks just in math and code. I mean, it's kind of weird, and it's hard for me to understand it. But I spent a lot of time around her, so now I got it right. So this is what she's thinking, and she's very hopeful. She says, finally. She compares this moment to the French Revolution. So during the French Revolution, people didn't have access to technologies. They didn't have access to reading and books and things like that. Education was for the elite. And so that moment in time, that revolution was a revolution of knowledge, she said, a democratization of knowledge. And she said, that's what's happening at this moment in time. And she said, and it's huge because it's AI intelligence. And bankers, she says, have been utilizing AI to make themselves trillions for more than 20 years. And she goes, and now it's just being, you know, given to people, the 99%, she says, now is they're going to be able to use this. So she's saying that this is a time that we shouldn't fear. However, it is going to be tumultuous. And she does say that we have to be careful doing it. But the way she sees it is when she's also an expert at quantum AI. So she knows, she believes that with a lot of people who are into quantum, you know, theory, that space-time is kind of how we experience our reality, but it's not necessarily the nature of reality. And so she says that the quantum AI is going to be able to access knowledge beyond space-time, and that the intelligence that people like Tyler D get, she said, remember when he talks about his download process? Mm-hmm. She says that basically he's functioning like a quantum AI, in that he's accessing, and a lot of people in human history, she believes, have progressed. Now that's the term I use. She would call it progressed human society through accessing this non-temporal intelligence, in order to bring humans to the next level, right? Kind of the next level of the game or whatnot. That's what she thinks. And she doesn't think that it's bad for humans. She thinks that first, she thinks it's inevitable and that it's good.
Is that what there's sections of the book where you talk about the dream state, and is that, are we saying that there's another dimension or another universe, if you want to talk about multiverse theory, I guess, but there's talk about dream states. And then there's also this thing that, you know, Tyler D has the protocols. And when I read from the occult literature, like for instance, Lords of the Left-Hand Path, it talks about how there's Apollonian and Dionysian rituals that they use, and they're very reminiscent of what Tyler D's protocol was. It's very much either overloading the senses or refraining from, you know, a cleansing sort of aspect. And both of them, either way, it's an idea of making connection to the divine, as they say. It seems to me like those are doing similar things to the protocols, which are similar things to psychedelics sometimes.
Yes.
and I think maybe so. Even Dream yeah. Suites. Is that all yes. in the same ballpark?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's exactly right. So so all of these spaces, okay, all of these techniques that you're talking about, and this is part of what I learned that time when I was talking to you in 2020. I was basically getting, you know, all this knowledge from different people, different communities of people who were really successful at utilizing various types of techniques to access these realms. Okay. So those realms then appear to be somehow, you know, on some level, not in our space time, but objectively real. Okay. Which made me then go back again. I know I was going back to the Socratics, but go back to those guys, figured out that there were objects like fourth dimensional objects. This is like, you know, 2,500 years ago. They used math to utilize this, and they used these protocols in order to access this. They cracked it abstractly, like they figured this out, and we're just figuring it out using computer models today. And it's still knowledge that's really hard for our brains to, you know, for normal brains like my brain, like to get my head around. There are geniuses who can easily do it. Okay, so let's assume that these places, somehow we're getting information from these places, which appears that some people do, and they're utilizing these various techniques to do so. So all of these people kind of converged, a lot of these people converged on me after American Cosmic, because they recognize themselves in Tyler D's character. And so I all of a sudden had direct access to different communities of people who are doing these kinds of things, which is then why I was so interested in John Dee, because I was like, wait a minute, there's a whole tradition of people who have worked out this language that they're able to discuss this with what they consider to be angelic or non-human intelligences. And these people are talking to me today about doing it, and they don't even know the whole history of, you know, of John Dee. So that's why I was really interested in doing that kind of work, because I felt like there was something literally true going on with these techniques and these people. And you know, it surely enabled these people to do some pretty extraordinary things in their lives. So of course I'm going to be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got one last question about the book. And this is because as I've said, right, I'm an Orthodox Christian, but I'm very much not a good Christian. Like, I don't go to church much anymore, but it's still like a core belief, right? Like, I still believe in Christ and I say prayers and things like that, but I'm also open-minded enough, you know, to a fault, that I'm like, man, I don't know, maybe this is all a bunch of BS, who knows, right? But I read a book, one of my more formative sort of red pill moments was reading a book by Father Seraphim Rose, who was an Orthodox monk.
Yeah.
You ever hear of Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future? As a book he wrote in the 70s.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. I think he was really tuned in.
He definitely was, because, you know, this book was written in, I think, 75. And he talks about all these things that we're actually going through and experiencing. And there's a section of the book talking about, and I'm going to butcher the guy's name, Teilhard de Chardin, Pierre Teilhard.
Yeah. Chardin. And that's my talk Chardin. About too. The newest.
Yeah. And Chardin's in your book a bunch, because there's one of the, I forget, I think it was Simone maybe, who was talking about his Omega Point idea, yep. This idea that mankind will spiritually evolve and achieve enlightenment into the samadhi, which is like a connection to God or the divine or something like that.
Yes.
And Seraphim Rose, he said, I mean, Seraphim Rose was, I'm not gonna say overzealous, he was very he's very intense, right? And yes, in his book he says he's basically saying, like, no, all these characters, and he calls out Deschardin.
Yep.
And he calls people like him out and says, no, this is all demonic deception. This is the goal of Chardin is this ecumenicism thing, this idea of converging all religions and creating a one world government and this sort of new age Luciferian, you know, one Luciferian world leader idea. Is he off base by thinking that, or should I be concerned? What do you think about
it? Yeah. So I'm fascinated with his work, actually, especially now. Yeah. And isn't he in, you would know this, I don't, I probably should know it, but I only heard about it, but I don't know if it's true. Is he considered like a saintly guy? Like, is, you know how Catholics have saints? Is he considered somebody like that?
I want to say the last time I looked it up, there's talk about giving him sainthood, but it hasn't happened.
Okay.
You know, I know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the guy. I know he was, I want to say he was raised and sort of became atheist, and he was homosexual, and then he joined the monastery, and I mean, then he just started writing a bunch of books and things like that.
So he had a major conversion.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. All right. This is like, you saved your, like, your most intense questions for last year.
Sorry. No,
that's okay. This is, I guess I call it an intense question because I feel like I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to be totally honest with you. And I'm going to tell you what I think though, because like, I think it's the most important question. And it's not like, I think it's like this Luciferian kind of thing that's happening, but I think it could be pretty terrible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I go with it. I think, is this all plans of putting us in a digital matrix so that Satan can destroy God's creation of mankind, and this is all a Luciferian deception? Like, that's where my paranoia, my conspiracy hat, that's where my paranoia goes with it. And I just think, I don't know about all of this, you know?
Well, so the way I approach it is that I witnessed too many things that were bad, and I would call them intentionally evil. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't use that word lightly. Like, we're talking about, you know, stuff that you and I would never engage in doing or doing to people. Right. Because we have some sense of goodness, or even if we don't practice it. Okay. So I agree with you. My tradition is Catholicism, but I'm not a good Catholic. Like, I even go to mass and stuff, but you know, I could be a much better person. All right. However, I have a belief, right? I do believe, I have this belief, intrinsic belief, that there's goodness. Okay. All right. So, so this idea of Deschardon, now I believe that Chardon actually accurately perceived this thing that was happening. He perceived it. And I don't think he was my own church, the Catholic Church, actually suppressed his books and his knowledge, right? They didn't want it out there because they thought that they couldn't tell if it was heretical or not, but they could see that it was visionary. But he was also, you know, saying that, you know, he also made comments like, you know, there's another species that we're creating that's going to come after us. Like, he said stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, and he wasn't using the framework of good and evil. He was basically using the framework of a scientist, like looking at this from kind of like a evolutionary scientist perspective, which back in the day was also new. You know, people didn't want to think that way in the early 20th century, 1920. Okay, so that said, I think that people like Seraphim Rose are identifying correctly a trajectory of humanity that I have to say is pretty terrible. Like, you know, look at my chapters with Jose, where Jose is literally, you know, this guy coming from the military saying the war zone is virtual now, and all the kids have the weapons, and the weapons look like toys, and we're giving them to kids. And kids are walking around with their phones, and they literally are addicted to their phones. They're addicted to the weapons. And this is how the war is being waged, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it thinking, well, actually, it seems true. And so Seraphim Rose also accurately in the 1970s then looks at a time that he couldn't know then. And, you know, so. So I don't know what to say other than that there's some concern here.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair. I certainly don't know either. And it's just one of those questions that's always in the back of my mind. And a lot of people will ask me, they'll get really upset when they hear this stuff. And because I like to present, I'm kind of more in league with how you're doing it. You're presenting the research and saying these are the things that people said and things that they, you know, people believe is going to happen. And a lot of people get upset by that. And they really want, like, they want to take action, or they want me to tell them yeah, you're right. Go, you know, protest, or I don't know what they want me to say. And they always are like, well, what are we going to do? And I'm like, I don't know what to tell you to do. Like, all I know for me, because a lot of people, they don't sleep well at night when they hear these things and they're very scared of it. And I say, don't be scared about it. Like, it's fine. Like, if that's where humanity goes, even if it goes all the way to Seraphim Rose's Luciferian world government and we're worshiping demonic aliens or whatever he thinks, like, that doesn't change anything for me. I still believe in Christ, and I'm going to die someday, and I hope I'm right, you know? Like, and I'm just going to live my life according to those values. Like, none of this is all, it's all noise to me, and I'm like, I'm just going to keep going down my path, and, you know, if that's the path you want to take, fine. If you want to, you know, start doing occult magic to talk to aliens, like, I don't care. Go for it, man. It doesn't change me any.
Okay, so, yeah. I'd like to comment on that, too, because it's kind of like, there's been a progression in my life up to this point where I had to basically kind of make a decision, you know, because I was presented with so much information about what's happening. And I'm also interfacing with young people every single day. You know, I have kids that are teenagers. I have, you know, students who are 20, you know, and I have like hundreds of them, you know, I see these students and they really want me to tell them stuff like what's going on. Like the world seems so terrible. And so what I do is I say, wait a minute, we have templates for this. And the templates are the ones that I talked about today. Like we talked about Socrates's Allegory of the Cave, right? Or Socrates and Plato's Republic. Like literally we have to utilize that knowledge now. Like we have to go back and say, okay, they were confronted with evil governments that killed their mentors, and their mentors loved them. Their mentors were giving them information that was best for them, and they were killed. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we do have to take it very seriously, which is why I say you save the question, the biggest question, right? The most important question for now. But I would say that it has changed me to the point where I've changed my, you know, you just kind of talked about how you're Christian, Orthodox Christian, and I'm Roman Catholic. Okay. And part of my family, by the way, is Eastern Rite Catholic, which is Orthodox Catholic Orthodox Christian. So, all right. I have to say that, you know, when Jesus, you know, Jesus looks like he was carrying on a similar kind of, program that Socrates suggested, like in the face of evil, like in the face of like an evil government, right? How do we act? And he was telling people to get into Gnostic touch with their, you know, with God, basically, you know, what God was for his community. And in a sense, when Socrates was telling his community to get in touch with the good, which he believed was real, the mystical good. So I think that my book Encounters is every single one of those people is doing this. And I'm that part of the reason I wrote it was because it was my way of sharing what I think we should do.
Wow. So much to think about. That was a great answer. Sorry to throw that monstrous question at the end here.
That's such a great question. Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, I want everyone to read your book, of course. Where can the audience find you and your, you know, both of your books, I guess, but the new one's Encounters. It's chart topping. I saw you're at the top of the charts. So congratulations on that.
Yeah. That was crazy.
Well, it's a great book. It's a fascinating read. I breeze through it. So tell them where the best place they can get it.
Okay, sure. So, you know, anywhere books are sold. So Barnes & Noble, Amazon, it's published by Macmillan Press. And, for me, I have two social media sites, one on Instagram, and it's DW Pasulka, and the same handle at Twitter, DW Pasulka. And I also have a website, dwpasulka.com. And I do have people that are impersonating me out there, by the way. So just so you know, really? So it's only those three sites.
Okay. Those are the places. I'll put the links in the show notes. And, you know, thanks again for your time. Fascinating research. Thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
You too.
Well, there you go. I don't know if your minds are blown yet, but if you haven't read Encounters, I beg you, I implore you. I don't always tell you to read all these books I'm reading. this is one you got to read. You got to read Encounters, because we didn't even scratch the surface. There's so much more. You should see my notes. I've got, what do I got? 14 pages of notes. Where's my notes? I got 14 pages of notes. And we barely got into it. There's other characters in the book, fascinating characters that we didn't even get to talk about. The theory about AI, 22 pages of notes. The theory about AI is expounded upon in the book much better than we could get into on the show. There's a character named Jose who was tapping into Chardine's Earth Soul, this network of energy. It's wild. You really got to read it. So check out the links in the show notes. And also, there's something else that happened after the show, you know, because at the end there, I asked her about Seraphim Rose and his opposition to Chardine's Omega Point stuff, right? Well, what's crazy is I grabbed the book off my shelf after the show because we were just kind of chatting about some things. And I got to give you a brief little background from Encounters. In the book Encounters, the Gray Man has a... I should really review my notes here. Hang on. The Gray Man has a dream, sort of like a UFO experience, right? Not a dream, a UFO experience. And in the book, Diana says, you saw Saint Michael, because the way he describes it, it's an angel who's like a demon slayer with a big sword and all this stuff. You'll have to read the book for more. But basically she says, I think you saw Saint Michael. That's what that sounds like, right? Well, I grabbed my book off the shelf, Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future, which is Father Seraphim Rose's book, where he specifically says Chardine is pushing us into a one world government. And guess what's on the cover? Saint Michael. Yeah. I showed it to her. I said, hey, Diana, is this Saint Michael? And she looks and she goes, I think that's Saint Michael. And then I open the cover. It says, the triumph of Archangel Michael over the Antichrist, who was shown falling into the abyss together with the cities of this world at the end of time. Boom. What's going on? I don't know. I don't know. I'm just trying to scare you here. No, it doesn't have to be scary. You know, that's what Dana was saying. It doesn't have to be scary. And like I say, hey, just stay on your path. Don't let the distractions get in the way. People want to, if you want to believe they're doing evil things, that shouldn't change your opinion. Like, you keep doing you, right? Be a Christian if you want to be a Christian. Anyway, you already know my spiel. But yeah, hit the links in the show notes. Grab the book. Follow Dr. Diana Pasalka on the social medias. In fact, she was telling me, again, afterward, we were talking about another character from the book. And she had a really fascinating talk about AI with her on Twitter Spaces. I'm going to go find that and download it and check it out. So, yeah, follow her on the socials. And on her website, dwpasalka.com, she's even got some courses you could check out and all kinds of stuff. So stay plugged into it. And, of course, until next time, stay woke.